You're listening to Weird Realities, the destination of choice for those inquisitive minds seeking to find that special place where myth, science, history, and folklore intersect, where we interview authors, podcasters, content creators, and filmmakers to discuss their work and projects, as well as dive deep into the weird things that capture our imaginations and stimulate our minds. Weird Realities is a Nightcallers production made possible by Lauren Smith Producer with audio and visual by Beaverhook Productions.
Hello and thank you for listening to Weird Realities. This is Hadley Thorne, and on behalf of Shay Tully and myself, I'd like to thank Finley Jones for hosting today's Weird Ink session, and also to give a hearty welcome to Weird Realities' newest panel host, Miss Morgana Calder. Morgana is a researcher of the occult, psychic phenomena, and ancient civilizations, and she's going to be helping us out as we dive into these deep mysteries. Now, be sure to show these ladies and today's guests some love by liking, commenting, and following our podcast. Now, let's go join Finley as she starts today's session. Thanks, guys.
Hello, and welcome to Weird Realities. This is Finley Jones filling in for Hadley Thorne. I'm happy to introduce you to Fortean and esoteric researcher Anthony Tyler, the author of Dive Manual, Empirical Investigations of Mysticism. Welcome to Weird Realities.
Hey, thank you very kindly for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. I just want to give a short bio to our listeners. A journalist and author from Anchorage, Alaska, Anthony Tyler aims to twist the knife in both phony New Age ideals and scientific materialism by drawing attention to the rich heritage of esoteric science throughout history. Far from being Satanist, the esoteric, i.e. occultism and comparative religion, marks the beginning of mathematics, astronomy, psychology, medicine, and even politics. Esoteric science represents a cache of little-known knowledge detailing how to decipher the human's unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind is essentially everything that the human mind is not considering at any given moment. That's a mouthful.
Is that from The Last American Vagabond? I think I recognize that from some. I know that's a description I have somewhere. It's been a while since it rang a deep bell in my head. But yeah, yeah. It is a mouthful. I feel like these days I would try to. I have a lot of different interests that are all rooted around a core theme, but sometimes it's hard to quickly summarize. And yeah, just like Fortean and esoteric a researcher are good. That's kind of what I say, but sometimes people don't even know those words. So sometimes I just say I research unexplainable phenomena, like across the board, really. I dabble in a little bit of it all. So.
Yeah, I had to tell Morgana before you came on that I had to look up some of these words because I did not know them. In fact, one of your reviews, Justin Otto, on your webpage said that your read was not for the uninitiated or the casual reader. And I went, oh my gosh, I'm such a casual reader.
Well, I suppose that is a little interpretive from what uninitiated or casual are, but you know, I think like, cause I don't want to steer anybody away from it, but it is something that you have to be already interested in, you know, like the subject matter isn't for everybody. Not everyone is interested in the unexplainable in general. So you got to really, and also it's easy to just toss around words and ideas, but like a big bone of the book and my research in general is trying to sift through just like some of the terms people toss around and find out where they come from and what they really mean and what, you know, separate the woo from the from what the data can show us. So if you're into that stuff, I've gotten good reviews and like the subject matter, just in terms of what I research in general, I wouldn't research it if I didn't find it fascinating.
It is very fascinating.
I appreciate that. But yeah, it's not for everybody, generally. So you have to, you have to be into it. Most definitely. Most definitely.
There's a lot that was very interesting. Specifically for me, the sleep paralysis.
Yeah, that's one that I'm happy to say has caught some of the most attention. And I think it's some seriously interesting food for thought, you know, because it's one of the research shows it's one of the primary like roots, if you will, of a lot of this, like the threshold of our everyday, what you could call empirical sort of life through the senses, and this extrasensory, transpersonal, metaphysical, imaginal thing that we got going on. It's not just one or the other. It seems that it's, you know, just to kind of dive into it here a little bit, like it's no pun intended either. You know, there's like root mechanisms of the psyche and our neurobiology and things that have been with us, that, you know, that we've adapted to essentially. And we tend to humanize those things in certain ways and transfer them amongst ourselves in order to, you know, like exchange them in order to, symbolize, you know, quality, because it's really hard to actually get a grasp on what quality is, really. And I mean, there's different ways you could break it down too, but quality, generally speaking, in a nutshell, is what it all really boils down to, the existentialist point of view. You know, because you could squabble over, and it's interesting to look into, you know, say something, a grand philosophical ideas, like, you know, like, does God actually exist or not? But it's also equally important, and maybe even more important, to take a step back and say, well, whether or not God exists or anything else, what do people get out of their belief in these things? And that in and of itself is a real wealth of information and food for thought, not just with metaphysics, but with the unexplainable in general. It's an approach exemplified in the work of ufologist Jacques Vallée, and, you know, it's exemplified in the work of Carl Jung and other people. So the existentialist point of view is really, really important. And going about that, in trying to verify that in practical ways, because we're never going to have all the answers, but trying to, you know, because some people, they take certain spiritual terms that make sense to them and they just roll with it. But these terms mean different things to different people a lot of the time. And there's very few control methods, for lack of a better term. And it's important to find some sort of control methods rooted in the human experience and then branch outward from there.
Yeah. You know, and that makes a lot of sense, because one of the things I personally tend to struggle with is on the concept of good or dark and light. Mm-hmm. To me, dark and light don't equate with good and evil.
Right.
They're just different pieces of your being, you know, and how you embrace that and interpret that. But, you know, so many people do immediately jump to good and evil when you start speaking about dark and light.
Yeah, that's a huge, huge point. Because, I mean, you know, in the long run, it's lost on people sometimes that, you know, the whole motif of light and dark, the yin and yang, it really is what, you know, like Freud called psychodynamics. They're using allegories for physics of the psyche. And it's meant to be a pretty clear cut comparison. And so, I mean, you can't, if you're dealing with physics, you can't call light and dark good or evil. They're just like states of being that can cultivate one or the other. And I mean, you get into alchemy, and whether it's in the East or West, and it really is all about the balance between the two.
Correct.
It can get really muddled, especially when you're trying to sift through the different, you know, comparative religion in general, because in sometimes, like, especially, you know, I've been interested in the trees of life and death in research, which you can find in, they're pretty pervasive, their motifs and ideas. I mean, in one way or another, you can find them in comparative religion the world over, but most concretely, you know, in Abrahamic, like Hebrew mysticism. And you find that the tree of death is generally considered feminine, and the tree of life considered masculine. And this is, I think, not only is it easy to misinterpret, but it also was genuinely used for misogynistic extents in sometimes back in the day. I mean, religion is was classical ancient propaganda, not always, but sometimes in many cases. So it really goes back to physics, and the yin and yang are the most, you know, concrete. I mean, it's very simple, but it's so poignant in its simplicity. That's why it's so useful to consider, because again, the trees of life and death very much are, well, I mean, they're the same motif, and the symbolism follows through with the yin and yang. It's just a lot more of a, it's way more complex. There's a lot more going on in it, but good and evil. And, you know, I think there is a lot of subjectivity to it. That's something I've thought about quite a bit as well. And it's something that is even more of a focus in the manuscript I'm working on now. And I, you know, it seems to be, so it's clearly not all in the human brain. It's not just that. It seems to be, you know, this crossroads, this like coalescence of, you know, forces of nature, deeply, of essentially physics, for lack of a better term. There's probably plenty more to it than that, but there's pressures involved that, create these kind of, adaptations essentially, and force us to recognize, you know, just to boil it down. I mean, I really don't think, I'm sure we, both of you, understand it, but like, because you were the ones to bring up the light and dark to begin with. But a lot of people, they'll say that you're being like a moral relativist. But it's really not that. I mean, we've talked so much already just about the existentialist point of view and the value of understanding the subjective nature. Because I mean, it's true. Like, the lion is not the devil to the antelope, but if we were the antelope, then it would be. So it's really the microcosm and macrocosm, you know, understanding the sort of like fractal nature, not just as above so below, but as inward so outward, in terms of reflection and projection in these things,
right? And sometimes you really have to, when someone else is giving you their give and take on that, and it's so totally opposite of what you're looking at and what you think, you have to sit back and listen, you know, actually listen to it from their perspective, so that you don't immediately jump to the judgment, you know, of they're right. Just, you know, they're an idiot, you know, I mean,
right.
Because, you know, there's someone out there that thinks the same thing about me when I'm giving my opinion. So, you know, sometimes it can be difficult, you know, to actually take that step back. And everything.
Yeah, very much so.
And oh wait, I had another question for you. It'll come back to me.
But
yeah.
While she's thinking about that, when you're talking about sleep paralysis, I think we've already moved past that. But
oh yeah, we could get back to it. I think I branched out from there, but it is plenty
okay.
There.
Perfect. That I had a friend that was going through a divorce, and she told me that she had something sitting on her chest and she could not move. And she said that there was evil in the room, and she knew that it was because of her husband. And she just thought it's because he was still in the house. and that evil was emanating from him.
I could see that. You know, there's the biggest recurring theme in sleep paralysis, and this was really the kernel that expanded a lot for me in terms of, again, because this is very much a crossroads between, because there's so much medical data now with sleep paralysis. So we can see not everything, but we know a pretty large amount of what's going on. And it has to do with this psychosomatic stress and basically your nervous system and your engagement with your nervous system and how that is affecting your circadian rhythms and your sleep processes. And there's a lot of it boils down to you know, stress and tension and what you could say trauma in one form or another, but trauma in the broadest sense. It doesn't have to be a deeply horrific life experience, although it often is, but it can just be those patterns that are slowly, you know, just a brick in the wall each day, with, you know, things like anxiety or depression or agoraphobia or the like. And it spills over at some point. And these things can manifest in different ways, you know, especially with different people. Like for me, I did have two sleep paralysis events as a kid. And I knew I had that. I was really young though, so it kind of worked out in my favor because it was weird, and I kind of felt like there was something in the room, but I was sleeping in bed with my parents, so I was just focused on like waking them up. So it wasn't too bad. But in you know, some of my worst states, I've had like really impactful, powerful, and frustrating dreams, recurring dreams that were very existential for me. And you know, it really is the same thing in the long run. At its core element, it's the body, or it's this psychosomatic process of, you know, when our regular life is not fulfilling certain requirements, it's going to our brains, our psyches are going to project that outward in ways to try and get us to take greater notice and provide us with greater context, you know. And it's not even that we're getting pretty you know, like existential and metaphysical with it, but you could take it very practically too. Like, you know, it's a hungry person dreaming of food, for mm-hmm. example. So right. yeah
and that's a very eerie feeling. I've only had it affect me once in my late teens, early 20s, and it stays with me because of just the fact that, like I said, that feeling of something pressing down on you and mm-hmm. just you can't breathe. I mean, and like I said, you know, even when you like come out of it, if you don't come out of it completely and it pulls you back under, you know, and like I said, you know, it's just this, you're fighting yourself, you're fighting whatever it is that your brain is interpreting it as, you know, trying to get past it and everything. So like I said, you know, it can be really frightening. And like I said, luckily, you know, I haven't had a lot of that go on, but it's that one event stuck with me just because of the impact it had.
Right. And that's exactly it. That would be the next thing that I would say as well is, now we know some of the medical data. What about the actual impact? Because regardless, you could say that there's this process unfolding with tension and whatnot, but like I'm in just as like an observer, different Facebook groups that talk about sleep paralysis, and I've talked to a lot of people in person as well, but that have said equally incredible things essentially. But especially in these Facebook groups, I mean, I'm sure that there's exaggeration and things, and this is all anecdotal, but regardless, what you can say for sure is that one way or another, sleep paralysis is, and really always has been, part a core piece of this conversation of what you would call demonology. And there's all sorts of, you know, when you look into when you sift through all of the woo and hearsay, and you get into more of the documented possession cases, for example, there's a lot of sleep paralysis involved in there too. You know, there's a lot of sleep paralysis involved as like precursors to like hauntings and poltergeists and things. So I think there's something going on here. And I think that a lot of the times, maybe you could even say most times, it could very well just be this medical process unfolding. But the more you look into unexplainable phenomena across the board, you see that this could be the case for a lot of it. You know, the brain does play tricks on us, and those tricks aren't useless. They have a lot of deeper meaning a lot of times, like a dream. But sometimes some really, really, truly unexplainable stuff happens, things that seem to be in weirdly observable ways, just as like lucid and conscious and sentient as us. People have very strange experiences in dreams and in real life. And, you know, even if one of those stories is true, it changes the whole game. And I mean, there's plenty of truth to it. So I think that with this, this process unfolding, all the psychosomatic process, I think in many cases, it serves as like a proverbial bottle for a genie. And in this projection that's happening, we might actually, that projection might serve as fodder for something else. If it's strong enough, something like picking up a signal.
Yeah, that makes sense. So,
because you have to, with demonology, the real issue is trying to figure out where the medical diagnoses end and the unexplainable phenomena begin. Because you look throughout history, and demonology was essentially just the beginning of medical science, you know, because it discussed like things like leprosy and smallpox and epilepsy and of course sleep paralysis. And you know, for the longest time, that was basically just the equivalent. But now, obviously, it's different, and a lot of people are, even like spiritually inclined people, are willing to just say that like demons are neurosis, essentially. Like it's, but I mean, really, that's going backwards, because you look at some of the damage that's been done when jumping to conclusions about things like demonology. We really have to be careful and give the medical data all of its due. But again, that being said, you know, there are Catholic trained exorcists that are just as staunch and serious as they've ever been. And I mean, there's current literature about it. And these things are just as I'm not saying they happen all the time, but they're just as prevalent in the collective psyche as they've ever been. And you can't, if you really, really want to, keep an open mind and look at all of the data, you have to admit that something strange happens sometimes.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you know, you can't go from one extreme to the other. I agree with you. It does kind of make us go backwards a little bit. But there are so many things out there that science can explain. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like I said, most of it, absolutely. But like, there's always going to be that's outside of that realm. And you, like I said, you look at the data, you talk to the people, and if you only find one or two, but they are diehard truth, then it's a game changer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So and I know another thing too that you have to do, or that I've done over the years with research and everything, is, you know, you can do all the research in the world, but at some point you have to learn what's garbage and throw that out, mm-hmm. you know, or what doesn't pertain to you, and right. move on to something else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There are, and it's one thing that I'll never be able to, I really appreciate tradition, but dogma is something that usually rubs me the wrong way, because, you know, part of dogma is so much about being right over wrong. And that's another thing, talking about good and evil and light and dark. People associate a good and evil with right and wrong. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I get it, but like, if you're just tossing out words, but if you really want to break down the semantics, like, is it wrong to harm someone, generally speaking? Absolutely. But wrong, you know, right and wrong are also correct and incorrect. And I think that there's too much overlap there. And you see a lot of people who are too willing, who are not willing enough to admit when they're wrong, because there's a far too much like implicit and misplaced senses of like wrongdoing there. And it couldn't be further from the truth, but you see it time and time again, especially on online and social media and things. Sad.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is, because, you know, when you first had all of the access to the internet and the information and everything, it was fantastic. I mean, because, you know, you could only do so much at your little home local library. So, you know, you had all of that at your fingertips, but now it's getting to where it's to the point where you have to muddle through so much sometimes, because, you know, people base so much of what they talk about on how it, you know, matches them, you know, whether it's religion or whatever. You know, it's not about, you know, okay, I've done the research and this is what I believe. It's like, no, this is what I was told and this is what's right.
Right. And it's okay to have a difference between fact and belief, and and also to understand that there is like an intersection between the two. But,
absolutely.
You know, it's like Carl Sagan has a great quote when someone, you know, from a couple decades ago, at least probably like three or four now, maybe, where someone is just pressing him about his opinion on UFOs. And he just says, look, I don't know for sure. And it's okay to not know. And you should be more comfortable with not knowing, like I am, essentially. Like, it's okay. And it's, and we can also, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to know, but we also, we should just sometimes be okay with the gray area. Cause I mean, that's a lot of light. And, it's so important to look into, like the more sold you are on something, the more important it is to look into the opposite point of view. You know, it's just your due diligence.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Totally agree. Because, you know, you can't evolve if you're not willing to learn. And, and to me, those gray areas are your opportunities to learn. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as long as I've got that to look forward to, then life's good. You know, that's just the way my brain works. You know, I may not like everything I find out, but I'm always better for having found it out.
I completely agree with that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have downloaded your book because I'm going to have some time next week to sit down and read it, just from the expert excerpts and everything I've found on your website. So it's very much got me intrigued.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank because you. It's you know, I think I had two or three chapters that I've read over, and they're like, there are gaps. So I'm like, now I've got to go read the whole thing so I can tie it all together. So I do see, you know, that some of what I was reading about Carl Jung and different ones, was there something in particular that built up your interest in that particular philosophy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, you know, I was always interested in the unexplainable from an early age, in varying degrees, you know, sometimes more or less. And eventually I got to a point, you know, I've experienced some strange stuff. Certainly not as strange as some people, but, you know, I've had dreams, you know, premonitions, essentially. I can't, not that I could control it or anything. And it's been a really long time. Doesn't happen. I think it's happened like twice, and only one time was it important. But and I've also seen UFOs in Alaska, whether it be black budget government or whatever else. I'm not totally sold on the flesh and blood alien, but point being, I became fascinated with Carl Jung because it's some of the only, not the only, but very much like definitely some of the best of the limited amount of resource that you can find that looks at spirituality from a practical, empirical point of view. Like I said, excuse me, from the beginning, the whole sentiment of the importance of the existential adaptations and maladaptations of believing in God, let us setting aside the actual existence. It's such a Jungian sentiment. And it's something that, you know, because people get really hung up on trying to figure out the quote unquote reality of things sometimes. And then they get stuck there in that one spot the whole time wrestling with that. But if you just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like answers on a test. They say, you skip it and come back to it. Like, just you skip some of the reality stuff and come back to it and just look at it from the existentialist point of view. And it opens up a whole cornucopia because you realize that, first off, regardless of whether or not something like a god or gods exist, their relevance in the human experience exists regardless and is very pervasive and largely unexplainable still. I'm just like, you get into archetypes and memetics and the way that the psyche processes information. I mean, it all gets, for all the empirical science that it is, it really doesn't explain away the metaphysics. If anything, it just gives fodder to it.
Right. And that makes perfect sense too, because, you know, I've got a logical mind, but then I'm also totally right brained. So there's a lot of conflict there sometimes, you know, because it's like, okay, that shouldn't be, you know, that logically cannot be, but what if it is, you know, what can I do? What can I look at that's going to make me see that there's a middle ground there? And if there's not one, that's fine. I'll figure that out too. But like I said, you know, having those two different mindsets sometimes can be very conflicting.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, again, I think what we're talking about in many ways, not exclusively, but, you know, it's kind of like dealing with like the archetypes of cognitive dissonance almost. And sometimes, yeah, you just got to be okay with, I think where the cognitive dissonance comes in is more so not in considering like two points of view. I mean, it's in not considering them. It's in trying to pretend that there isn't some sort of dissonance. And that's where the feedback loop really happens. And, you know, I really am, I'm a proponent of the, you know, the general sentiment of the whole God of the gaps, you know, like metaphysics of the gaps, in a sense, where there is this sort of event horizon, if you will, of human understanding. And I don't think we'll ever truly have the answers. I think very much, you know, at least from my point of view, it seems clear to me that the more answers you get, the more questions you'll find. And I really think that from the human perspective, it's just a continuous onward going thing. And I think there will always be room for the divine and the demonic, not just in terms of more basic, but still useful archetypes, like saying that something highly neurotic or something detrimental like smallpox, calling that demonic. You know, you see, again, we're looking at the continuum, like back when they didn't understand the mechanisms of these things, they were, as far as they knew it. But now the continuum expands. And yeah, it's the belief in many ways propels our empirical understanding and our scientific methods. And I think that when you slight one or the other, whether it be your beliefs and ideals or your empirical skepticism, for lack of a better term, you know, again, it's the balance that always is.
Right. We were talking a little bit before we got started about, you know, the fact that the human brain, we use so little of it, you know, in the general scheme of things. And I kind of look at the same concept where, you know, the universe is concerned. I mean, we're a small little speck in the universe. So who's to say what's out there that we would just turn our noses up at, you know, and everything. So, you know, it kind of goes, like I say, with that balance, there's always going to be that curiosity to expand what's there, expand what I think I know and what I actually know, and kind of find somewhere to join the two together or go in a totally different direction. It just depends on where I start at and where I end up at.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's a cliche for a reason. Like it's about the journey in many cases. And I really love the old Taoist saying that the 1,000-mile journey starts with the first step. You just got to do it. And you gotta be present and, you know, take the time to look around.
Yes, absolutely.
There's a lot to take in.
There sure is. Yeah. And, you know, equal and opposite reaction. Sometimes people ask me, because I'm a pretty laid back person and I have a lot of positive interests too, but I also have macabre interests. Like I could talk about demonology for a long time. And, you know, I like, it's, you know, music, my music taste is a perfect example. I like heavy stuff. I like really laid back melodic stuff as well. And, you know, again, equal and opposite reaction. Like when I hear about something like demonology or even horrific true crime, doesn't make me feel good. I have a pretty natural, reeling response, but I do know, because I've seen it in effect in other places, you know, in my research and my real life, where there's different ways to put it, but there really is just as much good out there as there is bad. And in some sense, it's almost, you know, God bless the people that have suffered in cases of like demonology or true crime, because those are good examples. But it kind of touches and highlights like the existential responsibility that we all have to not be the terrible people, you know, because the world can be a really bad place sometimes. And it, you know, if not for effort, it probably would be worse. And it's important, you know, it's pretty hard and rare for a single person to like objectively literally change the world, but it happens. And that's not even the main goal. It's like we're each a synapse in the whole brain of the collective psyche, and you really just have to do your part, you know?
Yeah, that's the like I said, the true life, because that's something that's almost a scary fascination. But I never really understood why I had that fascination as much as I did. And I guess I must have just blocked it out from my mind. My best friend's aunt that used to babysit us went missing when we were 9-10 years old.
Oh, wow.
And she was actually a victim of a serial killer.
Oh, wow. Which one?
I cannot remember his name. I can remember it being in Monroe, Louisiana, and he only had about 4 victims.
Wow.
I'll have to look him up. But my mom and I were talking, and I just for some reason thought about her, and she goes, well, you know, they executed the serial killer. And I'm like, what serial killer? And I'm like, so I don't know if I blocked it out, you know, from childhood, but it kind of stayed in the back of my mind because, like I said, you know, I've been researching serial killers, you know, for years. And, you know, it's just one of those crazy things, like I said, that kind of throw that connection in there that you didn't have, you know, those threads weaving together, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have an anecdote that ties in to all this as well. And true crime is something we could expand upon a little bit here too, because it really plays into everything we've been talking about so far. And see, my dad is a detective in Alaska, in Anchorage. And I know there's a lot of police corruption out there, but not all cops are bastards. I've met a lot of good ones. But he actually, and I didn't realize this until deep after my fascination with true crime. Obviously, there's a correlation with my dad being a cop, and there was a time where I really didn't get along with him but we get along real well now. And he told me later, I think this was probably just like a year and a half ago, actually, like crazy recent. You would think it would have inspired me a lot more, but he actually worked on, it was a small but instrumental in its own way, role in the Israel Keyes serial killer case. I don't know if either of you are familiar with that name, but for any listeners, at least, Israel Keyes is a guy. This was like the turn of like the 2000s, so like in that ballpark there. And he was in Alaska for most of the time. And he essentially was setting up, you know, his murder kits around, I think it was around the U.S., but mostly focused on the West Coast. And he just buried stashes of cash from armed robberies, bank robberies, and lubed up guns so that you could pull them out and immediately use them, and just like murder kits with everything to bind people. And he would take them, you know, so he would fly to a state. He would rent a car and get his murder kit and then drive to another state and pick somebody up and drive to another state and kill him and then drive to one last state and bury him. So he was hard to keep up with, but eventually he started getting sloppy and he killed a teenager, a barista in my hometown in Eagle River, right outside of Anchorage. She might have been in Anchorage, but I think she was actually in Eagle River. But point being, I remember like the flyers we all do growing up there of like missing Samantha Koenig. And my dad actually polygraphed her. It was her boyfriend and her father, just as like standard procedure. And he was also involved with following up all the random tips. So he talked to everybody, to informed people, to crazy people, to psychics, and you know, everybody in between. And lastly, was involved a little bit in some of the like the large network of people that were trying to track down Israel Keyes in through ATM exchanges and whatnot, which is how he got caught in the long run. So, you know, my dad never met Israel Keyes or anything, but he did meet, you know, victims of the family, and was pretty involved in the case for a little bit. So and serial killers, they have which, you know, you talk about how like sleep paralysis is like an unavoidable just aspect that covers so many different subtopics here. And is kind of like an unavoidable threshold of demonology. Serial killers, whether you want to be a skeptic or whatever, even just from like the objective observational point of view, they have a very large role to play in our perceptions of demonology today as well.
I've often wondered about that. You know, I mean, how much of that, I mean, is a person really born or shaped to become that, or is there some external force that's contributing to it, or a combination of the two?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's that whole nature versus nurture thing.
Absolutely.
But you know, I've found some really good kids that came from bad homes and vice versa. So, right. I mean, I think it just definitely plays a part, but I don't think that it's the complete story. You know, well,
I think that, and this isn't the only way you could describe it either, but I think that, and I'll definitely expand upon this because this is something I've been looking at for like my next manuscript and things. But in terms of like psychosomatic tension and being able to process the levels of tension and trauma in our lives, and because oftentimes when you look at people's stories, it's not even so much, you know, generally speaking, it's not even so much what happens to them as much as it is, right, how they process it. Right. So it's a strange mixture, but there's definitely a combination. It's definitely a crossroads of nature and nurture definitely can't be one or the other. And, you know, like, so with serial killers, it's really interesting, because, well, so I'll start with this. Like, there's the three classic forms, categories, if you will, of demonology, or like presence of demonology. And there's oppression, which you could say is like a poltergeist type thing, among other things. Obsession, which is just almost like a middle ground into possession. And obsession is probably the most like archetypal, because you don't even really need anything unexplainable to describe it. But the really curious part is that the more you look into it, the more you find really weird, unexplainable correlations and relationships. And I'll get into some of that a little bit, because so in some cases you could definitely make the case. No one's ever going to know for sure. So it's important to, consider that this is, a little fair grain of salt, like with anything. But there are some cases where you could make the case that a serial killer is possessed. In any case, I think it's pretty much without question that there's a level of what you could call archetypally demonic obsession that borders on a level of something that could get, you could almost call it extrasensory, but I prefer to keep it a little more grounded and call it transpersonal, like something that is so ritualistic and ceremonial and hypnotic that you're getting into altered states of consciousness. And I think that when you get into altered states of consciousness, especially when you're not directing yourself in healthy ways, it can really, create like a butterfly effect, so to speak. And maybe, like, to use another metaphor, like let vampires in. Because obviously it's the classic, like, it's a scapegoat mentality to say like, oh, I was possessed. And, so, I mean, just as a disclaimer, continue with metaphysics for fun. The court of law is like, we can't involve metaphysics in it. So regardless of what happens, even if we become convinced that someone is possessed, they still committed the crimes. They got to go away. It doesn't change anything.
That is correct.
Yeah. So that being said, I do think that in some cases there is some weird momentum that you might be able to call unexplainable. For instance, there's a few different pieces you could open up from here, but a good place to start further is temporal lobe epilepsy. There's a lot of research done into temporal lobe epilepsy, and obviously, of course, that doesn't mean that you have anything inherently metaphysical about you, but the unique constant aspect of that is because of it, where it's located in the brain, the seizures cause a person to have intensely psychedelic spiritual visions. And depending on a person's circumstances and preconditions, etc., that could be very good or very bad. There are several prominent writers and artists throughout history, the famous writer is not War and Peace, A Crime and Punishment, Dostoevsky. He's the one that always sticks in my head for whatever reason. But he was known, for sure, to have epilepsy, and I'm quite positive he was actually known to have temporal lobe epilepsy. And in the very famous case of Annalise Michel, the possession that happened in the 70s in Bavaria, Germany, something that seems very legitimately that there was something unexplainable happening. She was also suffering from precursor a disease and illness that were serving as fodder because she had temporal lobe epilepsy. And so you look into serial killers and you find, a lot of people know about hitting the head. That's a solid line of research there, like hitting the head and damaging the frontal cortex. Right. But, underneath that, the temporal lobe has to do with essentially our, you know, to philosophize it a little bit and to be quick about it, it kind of has to do with like the neurological underpinnings of our understanding of quality in many cases. And not just that, but like symbolism and like how symbols and our environment connect to our inner states of quality and things like that. So it's a very like indicative of spiritual experiences. Now, we know that certain serial killers have epilepsy, oftentimes from hitting their head, but not always. And it's hard, you know, because there's not always like follow through data in a lot of cases as to like what kinds. But in two cases, especially that are very interesting, Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, being one of them, is known to have was known to have temporal lobe epilepsy. Very curious. And then the other one, a little less known, but very infamous still, the Genesee River Killer, Arthur Shawcross. He was known to have, I believe he also had epilepsy. I'm like 99% sure. I just don't have the note in front of me. But most importantly, he had an actual cyst on his temporal lobe. And you find, well, with all the serial killers that are specifically fascinated with the occult and the symbolic and the dark side of philosophy, they usually more often than not are epileptic. Not always. There's exceptions to every rule. And so, of course, another disclaimer, I think this goes without saying, that people with epilepsy are not predisposed to violence or being serial killers.
That's right.
But we're looking at correlation snowball effects. You know, yeah. The butterfly effect. A butterfly, the flap of a butterfly wing can cause a typhoon halfway around the world. And the same goes with the human psyche. Again, physics of the psyche. We're talking about light and dark. There's actual physics here. And I mean, furthermore, the butterfly was represented, or the psyche was represented as the butterfly, like throughout esoteric symbolism, the world over, throughout history. So, I mean, the logic follows through. And think about it like this, in terms of metaphysics at large, we know that statistically, theoretically, it's very possible, no matter how unlikely, for a butterfly to flap its wings and cause that typhoon. But even knowing that, if we were ever to try and scientifically find a way to correlate that typhoon to the beginning of a butterfly flap, maybe we could one day, but there's no way we could tie it together. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it's essentially magic.
Right.
You know, there's other strange, relationships to serial killers and, you know, like occultism, for lack of a better term, and like demonology. Like, I'm not sure how much you two are familiar with, but, you know, Dahmer was trying to create the altar out of bones, before he was caught. And, Bundy liked to talk about, the entity, and, you know, BTK. There's obviously Son of Sam. And I don't think Son of Sam, I think he's a clear example, Berkowitz, of someone, telling stories, but that goes down a different rabbit hole. Because I do think that there actually is the evidence to show that he probably wasn't working alone. And how far the, you know, I don't go too deep into long withstanding, intense, like even like geopolitical networks, so to speak, right. Like some people want to take it to. But if you want to talk about organized, weird occult situations, like that stuff was definitely happening. I've actually talked to people that, we'll come back to the demonology a little bit. I didn't even intend to take this segue, but this is fun to talk about too.
Yeah.
With Son of Sam, I've actually in the past, I've spoken with Josh Zeman, the director of the Netflix documentary, The Sons of Sam. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten to pick his brain, and I've also poured through the data a bit. And I've spoken with cops who, detectives who like initially worked the Son of Sam case. And I've spoken with some that opened it again in the 90s. It just out of curiosity, really. And this is a while ago now, this is some years ago, but it's something that always stuck with me. And, it's a good example of like where fact meets fiction, because it was one of these kernels of truth that created the total hysteria of things like Satanic Panic. But there is a little bit of truth there. You know, Maury Terry, the author of The Ultimate Evil, which snowballed all of the Sons of Sam thing, there is speculation in there, like between the not even between the lines, but like, you know, how it's written, and this is a lot of conspiracy theory, is even the good ones, what they'll do is they'll start with data. And they'll give you the facts, and then they'll say, okay, there's the data, and this is what I think about it. Maury Terry did a lot of that. So you take what he thinks about it with a grain of salt, but there's plenty of data there, and it's weird. Like, there's definitely some stuff going on. But in terms of possession, I don't think Berkowitz was possessed. Interestingly enough, even though Bundy was a complete psychopath, I mean, they all are, but Bundy was a specifically charismatic psychopath, and he lied plenty. Looking through some of his discussion, some of his, I don't know, just like explanations, if you will, of what he called the entity. I'm actually, you know, again, grain of salt, even when I say this, but I'm inclined to believe him, because it's situational, it's contextual, where he didn't lean on it in court heavily, because anyone would be a fool to anyway. It's not going to work. And he also didn't really, he eventually towards the end, he tried to tie that in with like a porn addiction angle and things. So he did try to lean into it, but a lot of the time, especially like talking to, like there was one time in particular, he was talking to a really religious reporter. But the other times, so he's trying to play into whoever's around. But if someone's just trying to listen to him, he gave this material, and to no one's benefit. He wasn't going to get anything out of it, because it wasn't going to make him less culpable. So maybe he was just bored. But I don't. It's certainly good food for thought, because when you listen to him describe the process of this demonic psychopathic obsession that seemed to have like an inertia that came from outside of him or inward, it's very ritualistic and ceremonial, where he's drinking heavily and trying to get into an altered state of consciousness very legitimately. And you find this sort of archetypal what's the word I'm looking for? Like organic, not non-theatrical ritual and ceremony in a lot of these serial killers. And it's very interesting. And, there's also, you know, in terms of, people processing that psychosomatic tension and how it might let proverbial vampires through the door, there's some scientific data to show that the cycles that serial killers go through is indicative, not entirely, but at its core, of flares consistent neurologically with epileptic seizures. So the implication being that these people are still culpable regardless, but there actually are some very weird, bizarre, maladaptive neurochemical things happening, where there's some sort of intense buildup and it's triggering some sort of really bad hardwiring or miswiring even in their brain and causing momentum. So there's a lot of strange things going on. You know, Gacy had seizures. We don't know if it was temporal lobe, but he had seizures, and he never used, he always used edges in his clown makeup. It always made him look really creepy. And he, of course, could have been stories just to confuse people, but he talked as well about his alternate persona, Jack Handy. So, right. Yeah, it's weird stuff.
Yeah, and you know, and that's, I can remember people asking me when I was deep into that research and everything, well, why would you want to read about that? Well, in my mind, I want to know how their brain works, then I'm like, okay, I probably don't want to really know how their brain works. You know, as far as I don't need to be able to relate. Let me rephrase it. But people immediately go to, well, why would you want to know? Why would you want to think like that? No, I didn't say I wanted to think like that. I want to know what wires them differently or what causes it.
Exactly.
Totally.
Same way. I love to read true crime and listen to those podcasts, and I like to dive deep into the mindset of the people that commit those crimes.
Right.
What were you thinking? What was going through your head, and why?
It's also genuinely useful to, I don't know, for lack of a better term, to understand their predatory nature. You know, like, so you don't want to be victimized, and it might help to understand, if not how some of these people work, at least how they operate. You know, it's like the famous book, The 48 Laws of Power, written by Robert Greene. It's like a book about 48 laws of power and manipulation and how to seize that power. And some of those laws are common sense. Some of them are pretty useful, and some of them are really scummy. And, but they're probably useful. And the point is, you know, Robert Greene said many times, it's like, look, I'm not saying that you should use every single one of these laws. I'm saying that these laws are being used, and you should be aware that they're being used, and you should make sure that you don't fall prey to them.
Right. And,
you know, that's what this is. That's what this is largely about. And, you know, it also, the schizophrenia with serial killers.
Going there too.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because, again, from the Jungian standpoint, so let's say like a serial killer, the two that come to mind, the three actually, so I'll lay that out real quick. The three that always come to mind for me are Richard Chase, you know, Vampire Sacramento.
Yeah.
And then Herbert Mullen, which was the guy killing around the same time, at the same time, in the same area as, it's on the tip of my tongue. What's his name? Oh, what's his name? Big guy, Kemper. Mm-hmm. And his Herbert Mullen was a schizophrenic that was killing people to sacrifice to Yahweh, because he thought that if he didn't, Yahweh would send an earthquake and destroy California. And then there's Joseph Callinger, in Philadelphia in the 80s, who was a schizophrenic shoemaker that actually went on like a torture killing spree that was inspired by his schizophrenic visions of Yahweh telling him to, like, it actually morbidly funny, like it some of the visions legitimately started as Yahweh telling him to change the world through people's orthopedic shoes and like footwear and relief, and then it got into like sacrifice and killing and things. And then more people are familiar with Richard Chase, but you know, he was just the guy that loved blood and thought that his his head was falling apart and all these different things. But he also thought that he was being monitored by UFOs that were working in relation to surviving Nazis. There's some weird occultism in there too. But so from the Jungian sentiment, like, this is almost the hardest one to try and untangle, because this is the strongest relationship we have. It's seemingly unexplainable, but and it still is in many degrees, but we know the brain chemistry involved. We know there's a lot of imbalances, and we know that when people take medication, we can see benefits here. So there's a strong medical leaning, but again, this is why I think there's a continuum, and that there's fodder that creates fertile soil for rare cases where things can actually take on more unexplainable meanings. Because if they're having these intense visions of all this spiritual metaphysical activity, just to not mince words, what is the difference in the long run?
Yeah. Right. I actually had a friend once, we were having a discussion about, you know, people who brought you messages and stuff. And she had this gentleman that came into her shop about once a week and would tell her, oh, I have a message from you from Jesus. Wow. And he'd tell her what the message was. And she said, you know, for the longest time, I thought this guy is just crazy. She goes, but then I thought, who am I to say Jesus isn't talking to him? Yeah. You know, and yeah. Like, okay, there you go. I mean, you know, that may be the one. And I agree with you, you know, that it does, when you look at things like schizophrenia, okay, another disclaimer, not all schizophrenics, but, absolutely. You know, that maybe there is something else going on there. You know, maybe it's not just a chemical imbalance. Maybe there's something that's pushing that chemical imbalance, that's amplifying it.
Right. It's a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I do think that in these cases, it does just start out as medical things. But I think that there is a grander scheme at play. And when things are not, and this isn't just speculation either. This is disturbingly well mapped out in the possession story of Annalise Michel, for anyone that wants to look into that. Because not only is there so much documentation, be it medical and like editorial, you know, like reporting, but there was there's audio tapes you can find online of the possession rites, and then also she died, for anyone who doesn't know, and it changed possession rites and this threshold of the medical examination that we're talking about here. And those the three or four priests that were involved were actually tried and sentenced for manslaughter. So right. That is, wow. You know, very heavy situation there. And yeah, so when things are, point being there, when things are left unattended for too long, yeah, I think that things can snowball out in some pretty yeah. tremendous butterfly effect sort of right. ways.
And it kind of, it can leave, for lack of a better word, it can leave doors open.
Yes, you know, 100%.
So yeah, absolutely. You know, and like I said, and there are clear cut cases too of people that have grasped onto this and said, okay, that's going to sound good. I'll end up in a padded room instead of a jail cell or on death row. You know, because if you're smart enough to cover up killing multiple people over amounts of time, a lot of times you're going to be smart enough to come up with a reason you did it that might keep you from death row. You know, there are those, you know, Bundy, like I said, to me, he was too smart for his own good. Mm-hmm. You know, I think his arrogance was as much a problem as anything. But I, like you, I don't discount the voice, the entity, you know, because I just don't think that they did enough research into it. At that point, it was just about, we caught the serial killer. You know, mm-hmm. We've got him off the streets. Let's try him. Let's get this out of our, you know, make it history.
Yeah. And Jeffrey Dahmer is another really interesting example there. We've already brought it up briefly, but, you know, obviously there's no sort of condonement or anything like that, but there's, when you see the interviews with Dahmer, you see, in my opinion, and certainly the opinion of a lot of others, and this doesn't excuse it in any case, but there is a genuine level of like horror and like confusion of his own actions. And because, you know, Dahmer was such a shut-in, essentially. He didn't like himself either. And like the opposite of Bundy, who loved himself so much. Right. And Dahmer really, really, he actually didn't like the killing. He was so disturbed. He really wanted, he was a product killer. He wanted the aftermath. He wanted the pieces, essentially. But he didn't take enjoyment out of killing the people. And he actually felt really weird about it. And he had to get plastered off alcohol, too, because it got to a point where he felt like he could not control this anymore. And he even wanted to go get help, unlike a lot of other killers. But how do you go get help for something like that? It's a serious question. Yeah. Like he couldn't. Yeah. And so he just resigned himself to, which you shouldn't do, obviously, but he just resigned himself to, I think that's what happens. Certain pressures build up and your brain just snaps.
Right.
Just lose your mind.
Do you think that if he decided he wanted help before he ever killed the first person and he went and sought help, do you think that it would have prevented him from killing those people?
I think I will answer that, but by starting with a comparison. It's the same thing as possession, where even a priest says that a possession, an exorcism rite, is not going to work unless a person is also committed to it working. You got to have that component. So if they were legitimately willing, then yeah. But, you know, that really gets into, there's only so much of this that we can consider empirically, because, you know, how much is free will here? And I'm of the opinion that a free will is an ebb and flow sort of thing, because it's not just an opinion. I believe the data shows that, but the data is still, we're still trying to figure out what all the data means. So there's room for interpretation, but there's clearly determinism, but it's nature and nurture. And I think that there are plenty of cases to show that even if it might be rare sometimes, and even if some people might not operate with very much free will, I think in many cases, it's like exercising a muscle. You know, the more present you are and the more you actually try to work on yourself and improving your environment for yourself and others, I think the more and the more you understand the root causes of your impulses and your pressures in general, I think that you could slowly expand your relationship with free will. But again, I think it's an ebb and flow. And I think that sometimes probably, maybe in a case like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, part of the snap and the true ultimate point of no return descent into like that psychosis, that psychotic psychosis is, might be, some sort of like archetypal forfeit, you know, like selling your soul almost, you know.
I guess because he was psychotic, I just don't know that. I don't know if it's possible for somebody that's got that type of a psychosis to actually get help.
I guess it really depends on where the breaking point.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess you're right.
But it's who's to say where that breaking point is.
Right. And, you know, and I think sometimes, too, that when you start looking at the overall personality, it's kind of like, and it's not the same, but it kind of leads to the same, an addictive personality. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know people who've done drugs 1,000 times and walked away, and I know others, and I understand the addiction disease. But I don't have that personality, so it's hard for me to grasp that. But I think that there are people that, you know, if you're prone there, it's going to be harder for you to get help or for you to be able to follow through with that help because you're just not wired.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And it is very hard to follow through at near impossible sometimes, but not impossible, of course, because I think almost everybody at least knows somebody that was deeply entrenched in some sort of addiction. And just, you know, it's not the only reason, but that's a good reason why I truly do believe in free will still, is because I've seen that play out many times. And, you know, the ability for an addict to make a decision against all odds and inertia behind that, and then to actually stick with it. And, you know, you can, people usually relapse sometimes, but to continue, but to get back up and continue on, like, it's a very beautiful thing, and it really does happen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I was actually just with a friend this weekend. I hadn't seen in over 10 years. And the reason we had not seen each other was addiction. You know, she just decided that was not something she was ready to move past. And there was nothing I could do to help her except say, you know, I'm here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, finally she's there, and it's awesome. You know, it's fantastic. I mean, you know, it was like this person that I'd lost and everything. But like I said, you know, there are those that they're never going to recover from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, that's great to hear about your friend there.
And, thank you
very much. I'm trying to think. Oh yeah. There was, at the very least, I remember one, interesting a bit on the demonology and serial killers. And you know, two things that I've heard before, but not often. I'm not sure how many people are really aware of it. It seems, and I don't think there's any like statistical data about it, but it seems to be the case, especially when you look it up and like you look through the names themselves. The most recurring zodiac sign that serial killers are born under is Gemini. Now, does that mean that all Geminis are violent or crazy? Of course not. But again, we're talking about
couples, though.
Well, Gemini is known to be a little like go get 'em sort of. So that could be good or bad, I guess. Right.
Right.
But the other thing is, so there are at least two serial killers. I believe there are more, but I can't remember the names. There are at least two serial killers who were really fascinated with the movie The Exorcist 3. And that is a movie, I never seen it, but apparently it's not that bad. It's fun enough to watch. It's a movie about the like Pazuzu or whatever from the first one possessing a serial killer called the Gemini Killer and then going around and killing people. And it's about a cop trying to solve it. And that was one of Dahmer's favorite movies. And that was also one of the favorite movies and the inspiration for this killer, Danny Rawling, to start his killing spree. And Danny Rawling is the Gainesville Ripper, who also, you know, has his own place in this whole demonology discussion, because he helped write his own book in conjunction with someone else. And I don't buy any of this, but I think it's a Son of Sam thing where you could say that there's some weird, overt, intense obsession going on here. That, but in terms of legitimate possession, when someone leans into it too hard, like when they, especially when they try and actually make it part of their legal defense, it's like, okay, yeah, you're losing me for sure. But interesting stuff. Regardless, for sure. I don't know what the thing is with Gemini, but it's around.
Oh, is this what your next book is going to be on?
Yeah, it's largely, not exclusively, the true crime stuff, but definitely involving that, and overall dealing with the shadow in general. So hauntings, paranormal, and poltergeists. Cult leaders, as well as serial killers. I'm even getting into some cryptozoology some more. I'm even going to talk about UFOs a little bit, because that always floats on the periphery, but for me, especially since I've seen them in the past. But I get really tired of UFOs being forced down my throat. And I refuse to call them UAPs. I'm not into silly trends. No disrespect, you know, people use terms however you like, but seems like a weird, unnecessary update. And I just like UFO. I'm just gonna stick with it.
I have not even heard of UAP.
Really? Oh, it's a big push. Like every ufologist that's trying to like distinguish themselves from the like the kooks is saying UAP now. Because that's, what does that stand for? Unidentified aerial phenomena. And they're like, well, it's not mincing words anymore. Like, it's not mincing words. Like, they're like, it's more direct, but like, unidentified aerial phenomena, it's way more vague, and it's literally, it conveys the same message. Unidentified flying objects.
It's like, right.
Wow. I don't
know. So tell me, what is cryptozoology?
So that is the study of weird, unexplainable creatures that science hasn't identified yet, and it goes into there's a bit of a split, but more often than not, there's a healthy overlap where people understand both sides. So let me dissect this a little bit, because there's some people who think that it's strictly animals. Legitimate flesh and blood animals out there that science hasn't identified yet. And then there are other people who are more of the opinion that their place in folklore is probably like a strong indicator of their origins as well. And I don't mean that they're entirely false either. We've been talking about this threshold of psychosomatic tension and fodder for things potentially unexplainable. And so Bigfoot, Loch Ness monster, any hairy cryptid, as they call them, you see running around, whether it be dogmen or mothmen. Thing is, I think it's so if people are going out there looking for footprints and doing hunts, I don't think you're completely, I don't think it's completely foolhardy. But that being said, I think to consider these things as something as flesh and blood and natural to the ecosystem as any other animal is preposterous. I mean, we yeah. can't find any Bigfoot bodies. We can't find any bodies of any of these things, or bones. Every single one of them is eaten up by scavengers, the time immemorial. It doesn't add up. And that's just the beginning of why it doesn't add up. But you could go back to the Union perspective. Regardless of what kind of flesh and blood is or isn't in these things, people keep seeing them and people keep getting terrified by them. And they're oftentimes very profound experiences. And that can't be discounted. You know, so there's a difference between the objective and the subjective. And right. materialism just throws out this subjective and says it's meaningless. And that's just insane. Like, I think in many cases, you know, in the same way, perhaps, that a priest can show stigmata wounds, or a possessed a person being possessed can show that as well, or levitate, or perhaps even a way an abductee can come after missing time with weird, what do you call it, implants. Like, there's things that that can, in my opinion, this is pretty much as speculative as I get, but I feel comfortable at least given the food for thought, that I very much think that in cases of intense, like the outermost limits of hypnosis and altered states of consciousness, we can actually pull things out of, project things from our psyche that are as real and vivid as anything else. Not in the long term. They'll dematerialize. They'll go away eventually. You probably won't have any evidence, so to speak. You might have some markings left over, and that's the really crazy thing. So there's something going on here. You know, especially when you take into account poltergeist cases. Mm-hmm. There, you know, people like to be skeptical about something like a poltergeist because it's been made into Hollywood movies. But there are so many cases of documented poltergeist situations, like with that. We have so many witnesses to, like, in many cases, cops being those witnesses. So who go on record, you know, for those who don't know, the Church Street poltergeist that happened in the 80s in St. Catharines, Canada for like a month. This is one of the craziest stories of poltergeist I've ever come across in terms of documentation. There's a police report you can find online written by the highest ranking officer, who is a sergeant, who talked about all of the cops witnessing this boy getting slung around the room and chairs levitating. And
oh my gosh.
It is. He says in the report, you can see it yourself. He says, I followed through with the landlords. We looked through like any possible weird explanations for any of this phenomena in the building. I followed through with it in other ways. And the only explanation I have for this phenomena is that the little boy in this house is the subject of a poltergeist.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it's pretty hard to throw those out the window.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow. Yep.
Mm-hmm. There he is. It's, yeah.
So, and you look at all of it, this is why it's all connected to me. I think it's important to have different avenues and subtopics of research. Someone wants to be interested in Bigfoot, follow that. Aliens, follow that. Ghosts, etc. But I think that they are all stemming from a similar place initially, and it's this this threshold of you know, it's one of the openers of the Twilight Zone. He says there's a there's a sixth dimension of existence, and it exists. It is the imagination. It's like the difference between what you would call imaginary and imaginal. Imaginary is like a campfire story. Imaginal is more so. It's kind of similar to the word psychic, because remember, people, psychic didn't just mean palm readers and things. Psychic originally, when the term came around, meant of the psyche. So it was a lot meant to be a lot more practical, and it was meant to convey the scientific idea that the psyche is an actual presence,
right.
And similar to a presence, like a brick or paint and a brush, you can do things with it. Like, you can learn to shape it and create it and grow it. And yeah, I mean, you get a lot more hands-on with it than some people like to do or care to do.
This has been great. Anthony, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. This was a great conversation, and it was a pleasure to speak with you both.
It was, and we had so many things we didn't even touch on, so I know. We need to do it again.
Yeah, we could definitely do it again. Yeah, I'll be in touch.
Okay, great. Sounds good.
Well, that's going to do it, guys, and I hope you enjoyed learning more about Anthony. Tyler, if you enjoyed our program and you haven't done it already, please hit the like button, subscribe to Weird Realities, and turn on all notifications so you don't miss any of the content we're uploading monthly. If you want to continue today's conversation or just say hi, check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/weirdrealities, or find us on social media via Linktree. That's linktr.ee/weirdrealities. And until next time, know that the team here at Weird Realities appreciates your support. Until next time, stay weird.
That's going to do it, guys. Weird Realities has some great programming coming up, so be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and set your notifications to alert you when we upload new content. Until next time, you can find me on Twitter at Shay_Tully, and you can find Hadley at all the usual places at Hadley Thorne. And you can stay up to date to all of our stuff via Linktree/Weird Realities. Till next time, stay weird.